Yeah.
Okay, now it's going to be cool.
My name is Michael Bloodline. I'm a doctor and a science fiction. Thank you all so much for coming. And today, I'm going to talk about probably my favorite subject, about bodies, our human bodies. And I'm going to start with a little bit of basic biology. I'm going to talk about one of the key attributes of life and what happens if it fails us. Then I'm going to share with you some of the amazing stuff that's happening in medicine and medical technology today. And then we're going to look ahead to the future and see what I think is going to happen then. I'm going to have a few slides at the very beginning of the talk, and then we'll turn the projector off. And at the end, hopefully there'll be a little time for comments and questions. I've had a lifelong love affair with the human body. There's really nothing not to love about it. Okay, you can turn the lights up, okay? Thanks. Everything. And one of the things that's really cool is how everything is connected. You can start anywhere in the body and get anywhere else. So today, I'm going to start here. This is a slide of Entamoeba coli. It's one of a large group of organisms called protozoa. Protozoa were the first animal life on Earth, and in fact, that's what the word means, proto, first, or early, zoa, from zoology, animal. And many of the protozoa cause disease in humans. This one does not. This one is an innocent traveler in our intestines. Hence the name Entamoeba coli for colon. And it sits there minding its business along with all the other stuff that sits there, the bacteria and the viruses and the fungi and whatever, comprising our microbiome. Now for many years, our microbiome was thought to be inconsequential, of no importance, like other things in medicine felt to be in the past. Now we know it's very important and very central to our health and to keeping the homeostasis and keeping ourselves balanced. And it's important immunologically. The intestine is a huge part where our microbiome lives, but it's not the only part. We have microbiome in our respiratory system, we have it in our nose, we have it in our tears, and we have it on our skin. And when we go through the world, we kind of carry it with us. And I think of it sort of as this second skin, like an aura, following us around and interacting with other people's microbiome auras. Now, the human body has about 30 trillion cells in it. Our microbiome has at least 30 trillion cells in it. 30 trillion cells that are not human, other than human. And this is why we like aliens so much. This is another protozoa. This one does cause disease in humans. This is called Trichomonas vaginalis. This causes disease in vaginas. And the way you make the diagnosis is you take a little specimen and put it on, not a specimen, you take some fluid and put it on a slide. And you look for these little creatures. And the way you see them, among everything else on the slide, is they're moving. They're jittering around like little jitterbugs. And the reason they're doing that is because of these little things. on their ends. What I call tails. That's the medical term, their tails. And they can move, and that's actually a characteristic for all protozoa. And there was a time on Earth where creatures could not move. For the first billion years of life on the planet, creatures depended on the wind and rain and rivers and ocean currents to move. Now, can you imagine that if that's how what we depended on? Amazing. About 2.5 billion years ago, a remarkable meeting took place that changed the face of life on Earth. Two molecules met. One of them we call actin now. It's kind of stiff and long and tubular, like a reed. And the other one we call myosin was kind of squat and crab-like. And this myosin molecule attached to the actin and glommed onto it like a crab. And then it let go and moved up and glommed and attached again. And then let go and moved up and attached again. Well, this moving up, as it moved up, the whole complex of the two molecules shortened. And conversely, when it moved back down, the molecule lengthened. In medical terms, we call the shortening contraction. Contraction. And the lengthening relaxation. And this is how we describe muscles, contraction, relaxation, and it's the basis of motion. And in fact, actin means motion, and myosin means muscle, where we see it most obviously. So for the first time of life on this planet, creatures could move. They could move towards something they wanted, like food or mate. And they could move away from becoming food themselves. They could escape danger. I love the mountains, and I've been going to the mountains and mountain climbing and backpacking since I was a kid. And in my 20s, me and a bunch of friends, we went up to the mountains, we hiked around, and I was feeling kind of, wanted to get off on my own. I was feeling a little reckless, and I hiked away from the group, and I came upon this very steep part of the mountain, and it was covered in snow. And I looked at that, and I thought, wow, that would be really fun to ski down. And it was summer, and I didn't have skis, but there's a way of skiing in your boots. It's called glissade. And I've done it before. And it requires a very steep slope to overcome the friction. So I walked out to the top of the slope. And I didn't pay much attention to what was around me, what was at the bottom. I didn't have an ice axe, which is kind of smart if you're going to do this thing. I was feeling my oats. And so I started glissading down the mountain. And it was so fun. And Silver Surfer. And then I started going a little faster and a little faster. And then faster still until I really lost control. And I was just plummeting down this mountain. And then I fell. And now I'm on my back. And I can't slow down. And now I do take the time to look around. And I see at the bottom of the slope is a field of bare, jagged rocks. And I'm dead. I'm going to be shredded by that. And I happen to see way to the side of the slope, there's a log right before the bottom. And it's really my only chance. And somehow I managed to aim myself in the direction of the log, and I try to brace myself, and then I ram into the log going heck fast, and I hear a little crunch, and then I go flying over the log, and I come to a stop. so I don't die. But I can't walk. I broke my leg. And I can't even stand up. And my friends are nowhere in sight. And the road is miles away that we came in on. And this is way before the days of cell phones. And I never took motion for granted again. This is a picture of human sperm, and human sperm are all about motion. 95% muscle in that tail. And I show this slide really so I can show this one. This is a picture of a human sperm joining with an egg. And this is, it's an electron micrograph, and I've had this forever, and I just love it so much. It's so beautiful to me. It's not everyone's choice for this to happen, obviously, but if it is your choice, if you want to get pregnant, and it does happen, it's a miracle. I always say, let the wild rumpus start. As it turns out, this is not a human egg. This is actually a guinea pig egg. And it's used in a test for couples who are having trouble conceiving. And what's amazing to me is actually that a human sperm would join with a guinea pig egg. We're close enough genetically. We wouldn't expect anything to happen beyond that. And of course, nothing does happen beyond it, although things are changing rapidly, who knows? We could get this. Or this. We already got this, you know. So that's it for the slides for a bit. And I want to come back to motion. And particularly what happens when we lose the ability to move, what happens when we're paralyzed or partially paralyzed. And there are many reasons this can happen. You can break the bone, like it happened to me. You can have problems with your muscles, diseases, muscle disease, nerve disease, spinal cord disease or injury. You can get a stroke up in the head. And you can also become paralyzed because of emotions. Cause paralysis. And that happens in the lower part of the brain, the ancient, primitive part of the brain. I grew up in San Francisco, and when I was 16, my parents took a trip to New York where I'd never been. And I was I thought of myself as an all-American, kind of red-blooded guy. I played sports. I had a steady girlfriend, hung out with the guys. And we go to New York and we do all the sightseeing stuff. And one day I decide to get off on my own. I had a little adventure, some streak in me. And so I hop on a bus in Midtown. And it was summer, very hot. I was in cutoffs. Tank top, like most everyone else. Bus was packed. We could start going uptown. I'm looking out the window, watching what's going on. And little by little, the bus empties out. And then there's another guy, older than me, in the back of the bus. And he glances at me. And another stop, and then he moves seat closer. Another stop. He moves closer. Another stop. Now he's sitting next to me. And my heart is pounding. And then he puts his hand on my thigh. And I freeze. I totally freeze. And
have no idea how much time passed, but it seemed like forever. And finally, I leapt out of that chair and ran out of the bus and kept running as fast as I could for as long and as far as I could, and I never looked back. This is the Anthropocene. Change gears a minute. This is the age of humans. The Anthropocene is the age of humans. It's a geologic term, but it has biological correlates. Some people call this the sixth great extinction. I'm sure you've heard that. In fact, birds and fish and mammals are disappearing at a terrible rate. Dogs and cats, not so much. They're climbing. Humans are doing really well. Humans are thriving, at least in terms of population. We're in the cusp of a radical change, a radical biological change. For the first time in the history of life, evolution is proceeding not according to natural selection, or not only according to natural selection, but according to human selection, to our selection. We are making the choices, and that gives kind of a new meaning to the words intelligent design. It's an incredible time to be alive. Every week, every day, it seems like there are breakthroughs. In my field, we can now, using 3D printers, print parts of the body. We can print tracheas. We can print heart valves, getting close to be able to print bladders. Using inkjet printers, but instead of spitting out paint, they're spitting out bio-ink. We're making organs on a chip. We've made a heart, we've made a liver, we've made a lung. We have brain-computer interfaces with implantable little computer chips to bridge areas that have been damaged by strokes, for example. And we have gene therapy. Right now, there are at least six therapies that are in clinical use. We have two therapies to treat two different kinds of blindness to halt its progression. We have two therapies to treat cancer, one childhood and one adult. We have a therapy to treat a devastating skin disease where your skin sloughs off all over. We can halt that with gene therapy. And just last year, a report came out of a 13-year-old boy who was treated, who had sickle cell disease, which is a terrible disease, and it's marked by pretty nonstop crises of pain. So this kid was in pain his whole life. He had genetic treatment, and now he had been pain-free for 2 years. And those are just what we have now. Right tomorrow on the horizon, we're going to be able to treat cystic fibrosis, we're going to be able to treat hemophilia, we're going to be able to treat muscular dystrophy. And these are all going to be, all these are going to lessen suffering, and most of them are going to extend life. And at the same time, we're attacking life itself. We're attacking mortality itself with research on the telomere, on cell senescence, on programmed cell death. All this is going on right now. And this is the first stage of the revolution, the first stage of the Anthropocene biological revolution. Now, almost all the disease I mentioned are caused by a single gene, a single mutation, The second stage of the revolution will tackle the diseases that are caused by multiple genes, like heart disease and diabetes, and mental health diseases like depression. And in the third stage, which will certainly start before the third stage, we're going to start enhancing ourselves. We're going to start enhancing our genes, enhancing our abilities, enhancing ourselves aesthetically, cosmetically. You want to be taller? We can do that. Shorter? We can do that. Faster, stronger, more musical, musically inclined. We can do all that. Right now, we already know the gene for earwax. Now, most people in the world have very sticky earwax, and it's hard to get out, and sometimes plugs up. We know that gene. It's on chromosome 16. And by the way, it's the same gene that controls body odor. So we can do a 2-for-1. Not far behind. 100 years ago, Olaf Stapledon, the great British science fiction writer, coined a word for these new, improved, better than ever humans. He called them Homo superioris. Smarter, braver, kinder. So I want to go back to that boy on the bus. And imagine him as a Homo superioris. And he and so many others like him, they have no use for emotional paralysis. They have no use for that deer in the headlights, rabbit frozen in the track feeling, that awful feeling. So they engineer it out. I mean, who wouldn't engineer it out? So now the same thing, he's riding the bus, hot, humid, people empty out. The guy looks at him, moves closer, moves closer. Next to him, hand on his thigh. The boy doesn't freak out. No. He calmly lifts the hand off. Calmly gets up. Calmly exits the bus. No shame, no fear. He doesn't give it another thought. How wonderful. How wonderful. But, in fact, I did give it another thought. And, in fact, I gave it a lot more thought. And I thought about it over and over for many years after that happened. And I asked myself, was I responsible for what happened? Was I sending some signal to this man? What part, if any, did I play? And eventually I came to the conclusion that I was. I was sending a message. And it wasn't exactly the message that he thought I was sending, but it wasn't so very different. So where was that message coming from? Who was sending that message? Well, I was sending the message, but it was an I that I didn't know at the time. It was an I that was hidden to me. It was an alien I. And that I was not exactly that red-blooded, all-American boy that he thought he was. And that alien I understood that life and love was a little more complicated than that. And with time, thinking more. I became more integrated into myself. I became less alienated from myself. I became more self-aware. And life, as a result, became richer and fuller and definitely more fun. And I doubt that ever would have happened if I had not given that another thought. I want to take you now into the future, a little even farther than the future, about 50,000 years. And you are sent to Earth to gather information. You're a paleontologist. You love animals, and you love fossils, and especially human fossils. That's your thing. Come down to Earth, you look around for some exposed rock, and you find a beautiful exposed canyon. And there are layers of geologic time, and you see the Eocene, and you see the Pliocene, and you see the Pleistocene, and there at the top is the Anthropocene, the age of humans. And that's what you're interested in, so you go up there, and you start digging around. And you discover that there are two groups of fossils there. There are two groups of human fossils. And one of those are very strong, robust fossils. They come from people who are long-lived, healthy, long-lived. And the other group, a little different. They're weaker, more prone to disease, and shorter-lived. You think about it. Scratch your chin, whatever it is. And you realize that the stronger group is Homo superioris, and the other group is Homo sapiens, us. And at a certain point, there was a fork, and Homo superioris branched off. And you notice in this strata, this Anthropocene strata, Homo superioris bones are throughout from the bottom to the top, but Homo sapiens are also throughout from the bottom to the top. They don't go away. They don't disappear. And that's a puzzle to you because you would have thought being the weaker group, they would have gradually died off, but they didn't. So that's a riddle. You go around the Earth and you look at other deposits, you find kind of the same thing, and you also find something else, that everywhere you look in the Anthropocene strata, you find Homo superioris everywhere, but you only find Homo sapiens in certain pockets. They're not evenly distributed. They're scattered. So that's a second question, second riddle. Well, you're a scientist and you live for it. And you go home, or wherever you came, think about it, and you come up with a hypothesis. And here's your hypothesis. Your hypothesis, Homo superioris obviously knew the value of genetic therapy, being its beneficiary. They also knew the two main risks of genetic engineering. And the first main risk is that when you engineer something in, you can inadvertently lose something in the process. The body is connected. Pull on a thread one place, something else can come loose. This is called the law of unintended consequences. And the second main risk is the loss of genetic diversity. You know the value of a healthy, native, untampered with population, co-evolved with its environment. It's species protective in the event of a sudden cataclysmic change in the environment, the weather, a volcano, a meteor, or the appearance of a pestilence. The modified group might die off the native group sticks around. And that answers why you're seeing Homo sapiens throughout the Anthropocene. Homo superioris kept them there as a safety net. So this hypothesis that you made explains the evidence. You're very happy. It's a good day's work. You rest on your laurels for a day, because then a new riddle occurs to you. Every answer brings a new question. What were these pockets? What were these discontinuous areas? Well, these were wildlife refuges for wild type humans. These were where the untampered with humans lived. But what were they? Were they awful places? Were they barren, dusty? Detention centers? Were they sentences? Or were they Shangri-Las? Were they lush and green and verdant? Waterfalls, fruit on the vine? Were people trying to get out or get in? You knew in this world that there were divisions, and you knew there were haves and have-nots. But which were which? Thank you so much. I'm going to end the talk. And I have a couple more slides. I have a new book out. It's called All I Ever Dreamed. It's a collection of all my writing for the last 30 years. And if you're interested in these issues, a lot of it is fiction. A lot of the fiction, much of it talks about this. And I have another new book out. This is called Thoreau's Microscope, and that has some stories, a long interview, and an essay that also talks about the nature of science and the future. And both are there. I'm going to give a reading today at 4:30. And finally, if this talk interests you and you can think of someone else that might interest some group, please let me know. You can get me at my website down there at the bottom. That's it. Thank you so much. And now I'd like to open it for comments. I'm sure there's comments. Yes. Do I think that 50,000 years from now there'll be human bodies? Yes. I think we're gonna find a way. We're so ingenious and we want to survive. Yes. What he's asking is, as we engineer ourselves to superior people, how will the mind be? How will our cognition be? I think we'll become even more self-centered and more. We'll think more about ourselves over and over, and that's. I think that'll be both positive and negative. I think we'll do great things, and I also think we'll be blinder than we already are. Our flaws. And that's a pretty long conversation about brains, but I'm glad you're writing about it. Yes. Yes, please.
Because I don't need two people.
Not be different genetically, but in terms of mobility overall, the same.
I mean, that's a really good point. He's asking about the cybernetic part of that I left out, that I kind of intentionally left out, because it's such a huge area about the robotics that are happening. And there are also, I mentioned a little bit about the BCI, the brain-computer interface. I think that's going to be a parallel path. I think we are going to be robotically. We already are robotically. Skywalker. That kind of stuff's happening. We're doing nanosurgery, nanotechnology. I don't want to say one or the other. I mean, some people say the brain is too complicated to ever pattern. Other organs maybe not. I never say never. You know, we're doing amazing things. I think we will have AIs that are indistinguishable. But I still think there'll be people will face the choice of do they want to be that or do they want to be the old-fashioned classic Coke. Yes, to interbreed. Did everyone hear that? She was saying that this isn't the first time, that this isn't the first time that there'll be a branch, that it's already happened with the Neanderthals before, and that her guess is that they'll keep interbreeding, that humans like to dance, and I totally agree with that. Although I know that there's some issues about Homo sapiens or the precursors interbreeding with Neanderthals. That was not an easy birth for Neanderthals. Yeah. And we've always modified our bodies. Absolutely right, so that's nothing new. The man in green, yes. Okay, the man in not in green. I don't think you really want to talk about destruction. He's asking what's really going on right now. He's already heard that we're doing that genetic therapy with cancer. I don't think you want to talk about destroying a gene. That's a really bad idea. But I think what you're talking about is finding the part of that gene that's mutated and undoing the mutation. We're not quite there. One of the most exciting things that's happening, and it's one of the gene therapy that is being done. There's a kind of cancer, I mentioned a kind of cancer. And what's being done is we're able to take a person's, take some cells out of your body, amplify them, so you have a whole lot. And we take the immunologic cells called T cells. T cells are very important in the immune system. They fight invaders, they fight cancers. And taking those T cells and engineering them, adding a receptor on their surface, a new receptor, so this is brand new, this is genetic engineering. And this receptor will recognize the cancer as foreign. So the cancer's not flying under the radar, which cancers do. But now, it's foreign, putting those T cells back in. attacking the cancer, and that's very early but exciting. That's called CAR-T, chimeric antigen therapy. So that's happening, and absolutely, I mean, it's not long we're going to actually be able to go. The problem with many cancers is that by the time you recognize them, there are many mutations. So one mutation leads to an expanded cell line, and then other mutations happen. So it's hard to know where the first one is and then how to correct them all, but it's going to happen for sure.
Green. Michael, thank you. It's really a very provocative talk, and especially your 50,000 year test for this image of, with our medical anthropologists, separate species of Homo superioris. To me, it is not self-evident that that is a good thing to have a Homo superioris emerge like that. And I don't think we should just talk about it as if it is an inevitability, as if we, the human civilization of 2018, can't do anything about it, or at least consider whether this should be our future and how we might try to regulate or govern it somehow. So do you have some thoughts?
I have many.
Just one more thing, Michael, which is that obviously some kind of government regulation is something we ought to at least talk about. But to me, the big caveat in that is we don't have a world government. We have 200 separate sovereign national governments. And even if 199 of them do the wise and sagacious thing, there's always some place somebody can go.
I think that's right. That's the weak, that's the Achilles heel. No, thank you for bringing that up. They're enormous ethical challenges here, and actually what I write about in much of my fiction are the ethical dilemmas, because there's always ethical dilemmas, but especially when there's new novel treatments, like these radical revolutions, then the ethics come out, and people are discussing this all the time, and it's really good. People are talking about regulations are being formed, but the fact is, what you said is, you can make all the regulations in the world. Science is not moral. Science is amoral. Science will proceed. We have shown that time and time and time again. It's humans who are moral, and the only way that we can have any control is by coming together and doing our best to make that happen. And it's going to be, there's going to be control, and then there's going to be less control. Really good examples. Thinking about this a lot. 1 minute. So everyone's talking about the opioid crisis, you know, and how awful it is. And, it's awful. And they're pointing fingers. Or the doctors are prescribing, or the pharmacists, or the drug companies. You know, everyone is demonizing the drug companies, as well they should be. But in fact, 35 years ago, when Ronald Reagan came into the White House, one of his big acts was to deregulate the Drug Enforcement Administration, cut the budget so there weren't enough people looking at the drugs, and in fact, he wanted more drugs on the market. This was a free market economy. And so we just don't point the finger at Ronald Reagan. He wasn't the only one. AIDS groups at the time, this was the early 80s, they wanted new drugs on the market because AIDS was killing people. So that was an unlikely two bedfellows. But as a result, it was a lot easier to get drugs in. There was not oversight. There was not good studies. There was no one out there to study. And then the next thing you know, you have Purdue Pharma lying about OxyContin and spreading it out all of it. Now you have people overdosing all the time. But that was a political decision that happened way long ago. And before Reagan, there was more restraint. And after Reagan, you know, people tried more restraint. And it happens, but it's the crux. What are we going to do? What do we humans want? What are we going to want? This man has his hand up.
What you see is splitting, because right now we've got, you're talking about Homo superioris and Homo sapiens. If you're living in the same neighborhood, you're going to get mixed. Why do you want to split those populations so we can have interbreeding? And the only thing I can think of is, it's not interstellar flight, but very, you know, all these out in the tiger mountain are going to be a while getting back in.
Yeah.
And there's not going to be a lot of traffic out there. How are and what kind of, what's important for something in the Tiger Belt is something a little closer to the subject.
Right. Yeah, the expanse, right?
Yeah. I'm talking quite a lot here, but that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, no. where are we going to put these people? I say Hawaii, but oh no, I thought you were someone else. Please, excuse me.
You both put it in on bio, not the library.
Yes.
Have they enrolled at different rates in the past without meant that the people in the past was not different?
The question is, have our microbiomes evolved differently in the past? I don't know the answer to that. It's provocative. Yeah. Were they different because of that? I assume they were, because the microbiome responds to our environment a lot, and what we ate and where we lived. And sunlight coming in, all these epigenetic influences. I mean, that's part of what's so species, what's so protective, is this co-evolution. And that's why keeping a wild type, what we call them, is in a wild type population. Yes? You. Wait. I was pointing to the woman behind you. I'm so sorry.
Hi. Well, there's a wonderful movie that I'm sure you've seen that addresses all this, and it's called Gattaca.
What's a movie? What is a movie?
Well, it addresses all this. And really, it doesn't talk about it so easily, but it's really that common. So you can make your baby smarter, prettier, whatever you think.
Well, where's the man in green was talking about ethics. But like you say, ethics is fine for my neighbor, but this is my kid. And I want my kid to be the best kid it can be. How are we going to change that? How can we change that? It's not a good way to live. You know, all kids are precious. All kids are beautiful. Why are we going to? This man had. The question is changing the genetics of our microbiome rather than changing ourselves. I don't know of that word. I think if we did it too dramatically, it would attack us. Right now, it knows us as it lives with us. There's a very non-parasitic relationship. It's symbiotic. Thank you. Symbiotic relationship. If we changed it too much, it would recognize us as other, and we wouldn't recognize it as other, and there'd be a little battle back in the back row. Yes.
As far as keeping a wild type variety of humans alive, as well as like the Homo superioris that everybody wants to be. How feasible do you think it would be with data storage being as cheap as it is to have, like, a wild version of your own genome plus a fixed version of your own genome and propagate them both? Maybe your reproduction is only with the wild type, but then, you know, your child gets all genes fixed and has a clear.
Yeah, so the question is, why not just keep the untampered with version of yourself in your little vault and then enhance yourself in every way? I think that's the way to go. For sure. You really want that personal safety now. Forget everyone else. Just and then just do whatever, because like you were saying, we already modify ourselves, so just go all the way.
And that way you don't have to have the ethical.
And then if you die.
Do I want to fix my baby's pancreas or well, live a natural life?
If you make yourself too strong and suddenly you fall over because you can't hold yourself up because you got too many muscles, then just recycle and try again because you have to. Sounds just one. Yes,
I'm a neurologist, and so the brain stuff is more than earwax to me.
Check your ear.
So you kind of pulled in a lot of these threads that have been mentioned, you know, anthropology, ethics. Change behavior already.
which obviously you can change before we came. You can see there's a big military application where a brain stimulator is required. Okay, so we have people, we've got to have people who have stimulators in their brain that can change the way their minds work, perhaps in a way that's advantageous to them. I think that that temporally is going to happen sooner than changes in our genetic makeup. Already we can see that in society people are suspicious. I mean, a large group of people are suspicious of anybody with brains and can think better than an average person. There's going to be fear, there's going to be hatred, there's going to be possibly violence. People are identified as having these augmented brains. Eventually, our brains may be augmented genetically as well. And so you're getting into the field of anthropology, behavior of groups of people. You're getting into the ethics of, you know, is it okay to change who a person is if we're able to do it? And we will be able to do it very soon.
So there's a lot.
How can we overcome these anthropological fears of the other and actually improve our species?
That was a long, really interesting. He's basically saying we're doing this stuff that the neurologic implants overcome. We can overcome fear in rats. He didn't mention we could increase fear too, so that we would use that too. And huge ethical questions there. He's raising that. Okay, one more question, I think, and then we're. It's what time is it? Does someone? I got a song. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming.
It's hard for me to pick it up.
Trying to hand things to people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
I already have it.